The name Andretti is forever synonymous with racing excellence. Ever versatile Mario forged an unmatched legacy that continues to this day, having won the Indianapolis 500, the Daytona 500, and the Formula One World Championship. He's the only man to achieve this remarkable feat. On the eve of the 100th edition of the Indy 500, Mario talks about his 1969 victory, as well as the many near misses by him and his family. But first, we discussed where it all started, a small village in Italy known as Montona. Mario, I read that you and your brother Aldo were racing homemade vehicles and handcrafted wooden cars around the streets of Italy at an early age. But was there a particular memory you have, either of an event or a driver you admired, that inspired you to the point where you wanted to make racing a full-time profession?
Well, for sure, as young lads, we had our heroes. Well, one in particular was, written about it many times, Alberto Scari, who was at the time current world champion in the mid-50s, up to the mid-50s, 53, 54, 55. And and he was a big inspiration for both Aldo and myself, especially after we witnessed the very first Grand Prix in 1954, a year before we came to the States in Monza. You know, things like that. As young lads, you know, you're very impressionable, and the sport definitely captured our imagination, as you could imagine, also. again, you know, you always look up somebody, and Ascari was the one. There were others, you know, Fangio, you know, at the times, Moss. But Ascari was our guy because, of course, he was Italian and driving a Ferrari.
And I also read that you and Aldo parked cars, I think, at age 13. Were you always able to meet the speed limit doing that?
No, actually, I keep thinking when I valeted my car, I'm wondering whether some of those dudes do the same to the cars as I did. We used to do, practice starts, you know, burnouts and so forth. Those poor customer cars. So that's how we learned how to drive. Because the family did not have a car.
Even during your childhood in Italy, the Indianapolis 500 was a race that already had reached global impact. How much did you know about it, and what did you know about it?
Well, actually, it was in 1951 where I became aware of Indianapolis through a film, To Please a Lady, with Clark Gable and Barbara Stanwyck, and it was a movie about racing and about the road to Indy through the midgets and sprint cars on the dirt tracks, and then to Indy, and again, that's when we realized what was going on in America. I was 11 years old at the time, and again, you know, Indianapolis, just the name itself sort of got my attention, and that's it. That's when I became aware of it.
Now, considering the time period in which it happened, is it possible that you could have had the same career path in racing and international stardom had your family not immigrated to America back in 1955?
No, that would have been impossible, really. Looking at everything, the situation after the war, how displaced we were, and so on and so forth, that would just remain a dream. But honestly, the opportunities came along only after we came over, and you know, we couldn't have scripted it better, quite honestly. I know that I always say I count my blessings every day as to the fact that from a negative of having been displaced from our home and so forth, became a big positive in our lives later on. So I have nothing to cry about. Believe me, I always used to remind my dad, you know, we were blessed that whatever happened to us at the time, even though it seemed like a tragedy.
You talk about those opportunities in America. What do you consider was your big break in racing? Was there someone in particular who gave you a great opportunity that you made the most of?
Yes, I mean, you don't do it alone. I mean, I can, I have countless of people that I owe a great deal to for having helped us at crucial moments. There was just a local businessman by the name of Jimmy Taviani who owned a block plant anyway, but he was a real race aficionado, and he finds out, you know, that you know, Aldo and I and a couple of other buddies are trying to build a car, and he gave us the facility, let us work at his facility with all the tools and everything, and then even co-signed a loan for $500 that we had with the local bank, a Second National Bank here in Nazareth, and to help us out. So these are key moments, you know, in your career. It was my wife's dad and his partner that helped me buy the first midget, which exposed me to, in the area where I wanted to be exposed, to really go forward from driving our own car, the stock car, to open wheel. That gave me opportunity. So, and on. I mean, it's there were just moments that if it would have happened, I wonder, you know, how much of a setback it would have been. So there were, you know, stepping stone, one after another, that, again, you know, that certain individuals were responsible for opening a path for me. Again, I have many, many, many people to thank for, you know, for a lot of things that happened to me.
You made it to Indy in 1965, finished third, and then followed that up with two straight starts from the pole. You seemed to get a handle on the racetrack pretty quickly, as opposed to maybe some others who it might take a few years to adjust. What made Indianapolis a track where you were able to run so well there right away?
Well, I didn't only run well there. I won my first national championship as a rookie in 1965 when I finished third at Indy. I won a race. I finished a lot of seconds that year. So a lot of people forget that at Indy was only one race. You know, I ran the whole season and I won the national championship in that year. So, and the following year, I was on pole at Indy. I won the national championship again. In 67, I was on pole at Indy. I didn't finish. You know, we had mechanical. And I won the national championship again. I won three straight national championships after my first, you know, rookie year, 1965. So it's not just Indy. I was winning everywhere, you know. And you know, Indy was worked fine with me because the car was good, and I took to it, you know, in a very positive way with a degree of confidence, which I think is very important. And I did not let it intimidate me, even, you know, as a rookie, at a young age. Again, I respected it. But at the same time, I just, you know, grabbed the bull by the horns, if you will. And it worked for me.
Another great race that you started in and won was the Daytona 500. You made three starts there from 66 through 68 and won in 1967.
Mario Andretti ready to take the checkered flag, and there it is. He made it. Mario Andretti has won the 1967 Daytona 500. He's won it with an average speed of 146.9 miles per hour. However, that's deceiving because there were nine yellow flags today. Had it not been for that, the average speed could have been well up in the 170s, I should think.
How difficult of a transition, or if it was difficult, What was there any learning curve to you to adjust it from the open wheel cars to the stock cars in NASCAR?
Well, there is a definite difference in the approach, the feeling of the car, the skills that you need to develop. Each different category is like a different animal, you know. But I pride myself in trying to become as versatile as possible, because I felt that opened up a whole new dimension for me. Had the opportunity to drive for top teams, like it was for a Ford factory team at Daytona. 2 weeks later, I won the 12 Hours of Sebring with Bruce McLaren in another Ford, a Mark IV Ford, which was part of their Great Le Mans program. So you talk about different animals, you know, open wheel, then the stock car, then the sports car, you know. So I was very fortunate to have these opportunities, but also took advantage of it. And I was lucky enough to bring some results back, you know. So all of these, these factors played huge, you know, in my confidence as a driver, and it paid me back many, many times, many years.
The man of the hour, it appears, is Mario Andretti. This huge crowd getting ready to welcome Mario as a champion. He has been the USAC, United States Automobile Club champion, a couple of times before, but never a winner at Indianapolis. And the crowd beginning to pay its tribute to Andretti, the young man who came to this country at the age of 14 as an immigrant from Italy. He had driven racing cars even before he came over here. This was the one he wanted more than anything else in the world. And here it comes, Mario. The checkered flag of victory. He's done it.
I'd have to imagine, like most others who were watching that day, you felt you'd be ending up in victory lane a few more times in the future.
Yeah, no question. I remember that in 69 was only the second time that I finished that race, because I finished in 65, my rookie year, finished third. Then 66, 67, 68, I dropped out with mechanicals. And 69 was the second race after, what, four or five tries that I finished, and we won it. So I felt big, you know, weight off my shoulder, because I always say, many times your career is judged with your performance at Indy, which is very unfair, you know, unfair to people that have never won it, great drivers that never won it. Like you said, I felt that, okay, I get this one under my belt, and hopefully, God willing, I'll have more. Well, I came close. I dominated Indy more than any of the four-time winners did, you know, but it was tough getting to the last, finish the last 100 miles. You know, I just didn't have a lot of luck in that respect, but, I'm third all-time as far as lap leader there, so I had my good times there. I've been on pole several times on the front row, and I was always, in contention, which is very important to me. Deep down, I am quite satisfied with my career, even just at Indy as that one race, even though statistically I only show, that I only won once. I won in 81, and then, it was just like a crazy thing that happened there. Well, actually, Bobby Allison, the one, was penalized because he passed under the yellow under the rule book, and then they, 6 months later, reinstated him, only gave him a fine. Something was kind of ludicrous, but anyway, 87, I controlled that race. I was quickest every single day of practice. I was on pole. I was every lap, except for two laps during the pit stops. I led every lap of the race with 23 laps to go, and while I was saving my engine, but the engine expired. So, stuff like that. And And who wins? Al Unser wins. He was over a lap behind me. You know, so again, when it looks at Indy, it's a bittersweet. You know, the memory's there, but at the same time, I look at the sweet more than the bitter. We had near misses with my son, my grandson. Mm-hmm. You know, Michael is another one. You know, he dominated that race like no other four-time winner has done, and yet he never won it. It was 1992, and the engine, you know, broke and gave the race to Al Unser Sr. You know, so how do you know what I mean? It's but because he didn't win Indy, sometimes, you know, I say, oh gosh, you know, he didn't win Indy. Well, you know what? He knew how.
11 laps to go in the Indy 500, and Michael is slowing. Michael is slowing. The rest of the field is coming past. Michael Andretti is slowing down. Al Unser Jr. will take the lead as Michael Andretti slows down at Indianapolis. An unbelievable turn of events. The man who has dominated this race on the 189th lap. Suddenly, the car slows, and Michael appears to be done.
As you said, a lot of, you know, misfortune, and there hasn't been an Andretti in Victory Lane in the Indy 500 since 69. And you said Michael and Marco. That has amplified the term Andretti curse. When did you first start hearing of this, and do you know how it got started?
Well, this was at Tom Carnegie's thing. You know, he was the very flavorful announcer there. He would come up with terms, and he come up with that one. Sort of this stuck. I don't like it at all. I don't call it a curse whatsoever. I think in many ways, you know, we've been blessed and very fortunate. We had near misses that we got away with. I have a lot to be proud of, you know, when it comes to Indy. You know, it cannot be a curse when you got four family members entered that race in 91, 92. It's never been done before or since. And I've had, you know, myself, my son Michael, my grandson Marco, my other son Jeff, all winning Rookie of the Year, which is prestigious there at Indy. So my nephew John has raced there and has done well. So again, you know, as a family, Indy has been very good to us. You know, I always look at the positive side. So that's really where, you know, that's where I am.
Yeah, it seems like you can take solace even after frustrating outcomes, 81, 87, knowing that you led all those laps, you did all that you could do, just luck was on your side. It seems like what I'm hearing is that it's almost, that's more satisfying than if you were never in contention at all.
Absolutely. You know, it's, you know, deep down, nobody would appreciate, but from my own standpoint, I have a lot more pride in knowing that I've been competitive and then I've been cheated out of something that's out of my control, rather than just, I mean, maybe riding along and all of a sudden it's given to me as a gift. Yeah, okay, you got another trophy, but, you know, I know, we all know, you know, if you were really competitive, if you had your control of the race and you were, and it was, they had to beat you, you didn't have to beat them. You know, there's a big difference in that. And fortunately, I felt that way several times there, and many times. You know, it's, but in those days, the reliability, you know, of those engines, you know, the rules were different. And obviously, we used to, you know, take every less gut out of them. You know, today the rules are such that the engines have to do so many miles, so they're much more reliable. And today, these drivers have the best chance of finishing than ever. which was always a big problem, you know, with us, that like myself, who was always pushing really hard. Like I said, I'm very, very proud of and not what I was able to accomplish there, but also as my family has been able to do there, and the record that we have.
You mentioned 81, probably the most controversial ending in Indy 500 history. Unfortunately, you are on the short end of that controversial decision, made 6 months afterwards. The blending rule, where Bobby Unser originally was ruled that he illegally passed cars under the caution and didn't abide by that rule, was issued a one-lap penalty after the day after the race, and you were made the winner. But after appeal by Unser and owner Roger Penske, the penalty was overturned and Unser retained the title. Some say the rule in place wasn't very clear. Did you see that blending rule as being clear?
No, the blending rule was clear as daylight. As a matter of fact, I mean, even the announcers, I have that, you know, that film. The announcers, Jackie Stewart and Jim McKay, even said, you can't do that.
Bobby out again, and Bobby going out very, he passed a car. What's he doing? He's passed about half a dozen cars.
Oh, James, that's...
Under the yellow, you can't do that.
That is a no-no. He has accelerated probably in the haste of leaving the pit lane. He's certainly overtaken these other cars. I'm not sure why he did that. I know that you're certainly not supposed to do it. The regulations say that under yellow flag conditions, you must not pass any other cars, and that certainly has been the case here. He certainly passed other cars. Right now, of course, they're under the yellow. There you see him in the blue and red car there, blue and yellow car.
But you're supposed to blend into the traffic, right? Let's see if he did that at all.
Yes, you are supposed to leave that pit lane, and if you have to pass a car for other reasons, it's for blending purposes. But certainly he has accelerated all the way down below the double yellow line there and simply overtaken a lot of cars there. I'm sure Bobby must know the regulations. I'm sure he knew what he was doing. Whether his mind was somewhere else, I can't say, obviously. But he shouldn't, in my opinion, have passed these other cars, Jim.
And that was definitely, and the reason at Indianapolis, the finish was never official until the day after. Like they would run through the tapes and everything. And nowadays with computers, they send the penalties out promptly. Now you commit the infraction and you get the penalty. You get like a drive through or something like that. But in those days, you didn't. That, you know, it was you got the penalties later. And so, okay, so they found the infraction that he passed 11 cars. Don't forget, I was coming out of the pits with him. He was, we went into the pits together. He was first, I was second. We came out of the pits. It was during the yellow. We came out of the pits together, and it was clear the rule that the pack happened to be alongside of us as we were exiting the pits. And the rule was clear. When you come out at the end of the wall in the pits, you look over, and the car that you see, that's the car you blend in behind in turn two when you enter the track. Well, he kept going. He went right up, and there were 11 cars between the car that he saw and the pace car. He went right up to behind the pace car and right into the lead. And I'm screaming to my... to my engineer, says Jim. I said, "What the hell is going on?" Said, no. He said, "You stay where you are. Stay where you are." He said. So I blended in 11 cars behind him, and so okay, I finished second to him. You know, I crossed the finish line first. Then he's given the penalty by the book. We go through all the ceremonies, the usual, the banquet, everything. I'm given all the trophy and everything. And then Roger Penske had the right to appeal, and they dragged it on. He was smart. He brought in, you know, a high-powered lawyer from Philadelphia, you know, that I think intimidated some of his, the lawyer that this series had. And they dragged it on for 6 months, and then they talked the league into appointing three judges to make the final decision. Well, two judges were totally out of the sport. There was only one that was actually part of the sport, you know, this Charlie Brockman, who was a local radio personality. So these judges said, okay, he committed the infraction, but in this case, listen to this, in this case, the penalty is too severe. So they fined him $40,000 and reinstalled him as a winner. Now, it gets better. Listen to this. The following year, during the driver's meeting, after the meeting is over, I raised my hand. Tom Binford was the race director. I said, Tom, I said, just to get it clear, I said, any rule changes from last year? He said, nope. Okay, I said, so today, if I pass 11 cars under the yellow and cross the finish line first, is the fine still $40,000? Oh, no, he can't do that. Oh, so the rule book will apply this year, but it didn't apply last year. He said, well, it's out of my hands. You know, it's true. He's the one that penalized Bobby, but, you know, the Roger Penske situation, bringing an outside lawyer, they won the case. And it was a farce, in my opinion, it really was. And that's one that I could never swallow, never accept. As a matter of fact, if you look at my right hand, I'm still wearing the 1981 ring, you know, so just as a protest. But, you know, I could never accept that one, but it went down, so.
At least they didn't tell you to give the ring back.
No, they didn't have the gall to do that.
I was going to mention the broadcast of the race, and I remember, I think it was on ESPN Classic, where you and Bobby Unser, and I think it was Jack Arute, were all, you know, a three-way interview, I guess, via satellite. And was that the first time you had talked to Bobby Unser about that moment?
Yeah, but, you know, I don't blame Bobby Unser. I don't blame Roger Penske for protesting and getting their way. I blame, at the time, I blame the USAC, the series, for allowing outsiders to come in and change the rule book. I mean, it's if you look back 2 years before, there were other two instances, you know, where Puncher Carter was one, you know, he had a violation, and he had the best finish ever in his career. He was second. They moved him, you know, lost the lap, they moved him to sixth. And you know, there were other situations, like, clearly, you know, recent, but just because he crossed the finish line first, you know, all of a sudden, oh, yeah, but the penalty is too severe now. The rule book doesn't apply. That's the part that actually was hard to accept. And I've not accepted it yet. I mean, it's, you know, on record it is, but it is what it is. But he did not win that race.
And another race that you should have won was 87. Now, this is a little bit of a different circumstance, a disappointment on the track, as you had talked about, winning the pole, dominating the month, leading 170, I believe, of the first 177 laps, and then the broken valve forced you out. How fast do you remember that car being, not just for the race, but the whole month of May?
Well, that was an amazing, you know, month that I had. I had with me one of the top engineers ever, you know, Adrian Newey, who has had, you know, tremendous success, you know, in Formula One as well. He was with me that year, and we really, really had the car working, and it's one of those races, like I said, Brian, that entering, you know, I said, today they have to beat me. I just felt so, you know, confident, and the performance of the car proved that, you know. So here's a situation where I've always, you know, been blamed for being so hard on the car and everything, and so I had such a comfortable lead, especially coming to the end there, that, you know, we have, you know, six gears in a gearbox, and usually we use fifth and sixth, you know, in case you want to save the engine, run lower revs, you know, if you're in that, you know, great position, you do that. So I was running the lowest revs, you know, in sixth gear while I was trying to bring it home. And without knowing, I was running the bad harmonics of the engine. And that's what caused the valve, you know, to drop a valve. If I would have been pressed and run fifth gear, would have been like 500 revs more. According to the engine guys, they did a simulation on the engine on the dyno. I would have finished the race. So here, you know, trying to be easy on a car, all of a sudden I took myself out of the race. So you go figure.
That was a glance at Mario possibly starting for the pits. Mario on the right of your screen. He's not starting for the pits.
Oh, my goodness. It's happened again.
It has happened.
It has happened again, and you can hear the crowd responding. Lady Luck has reared what is to Mario her ugly head at Indianapolis again.
Your final IndyCar season, and thus your final Indianapolis 500, was 1994, and thus concluding a career in which the length and breadth is just remarkable, and the accomplishments, I mean, I don't have time to list them all, but taking into account the Daytona 500 victory, the Indy 500 win, the Formula One championship back in 1978, four IndyCar championships, is there any accomplishment, any victory that stands out as your most rewarding?
They all are, quite honestly. I mean, any given day, so this was the greatest day of my career, you know, but when you look back overall, I mean, there's, you know, no matter how fortunate you've been, you know, with having had a long career and so forth, still, by numbers, the victories are seem like far in between been. So they're all so precious, you know, when I look back, I figure how I'm so lucky I've been, you know, to have had these opportunities and go in areas like, you know, Formula One, which is my original dream, and go there and accomplish my ultimate goal and all of that. And having had, you know, a good career in sports cars, having had my victories, you know, especially with Ferrari and having driven for Ferrari, having won with Ferrari, Formula One and sports cars, and you know, all these things play huge for me. And again, that's, but it's hard to just single out anyone in particular. Like I said, depending on the mood, any given day I could pick, yes, but overall, like I said, I just been one lucky dude, that's all.
But Mario Andretti is driving the race of his life. Hunt slips back to seventh, but the champion's out of it. Andretti stays in front till the flag. Lauda is second, almost sure of the championship now. Alan Jones third. But the Italian Grand Prix goes to the best driver on the day, Mario Andretti.
I spoke to Bobby Rahal recently and asked him if there was any way to prepare for the nervousness that comes with watching his son race. For you, I guess we can take that a few steps further. You've had more than one son on the track. You've raced against your sons. You've had the chance to watch your grandson compete, Marco. And watching a son or grandson from afar is one thing. But how does that compare with the helpless feeling of racing against them, as you did several times, and not being and being concerned for their well-being from the cockpit?
Well, quite honestly, when I was on the track with them, it was a lot easier for some reason. It almost felt like, I don't know, like I felt like I had better control of things, you know. But watching from the sidelines is the worst. I'm terrible, you know. I can never even watch the starts, you know. When these guys, I watched the reaction on the engineer's face or something like that. You know, hope it's a good one, especially at the starts. But yeah, I'm a nervous Nelly on the side, no question about it. I'll confess to that. That somewhat made me appreciate, you know, the feelings that my wife has been experiencing, you know, all of our lives here, you know, in the racing world. Yeah, it is. It's a tough one in that sense. It really is, knowing what they're up against, what they're facing, and how important it is, you know, to pull through okay, and you know, all those factors. I'm not a cool cat on the sidelines at all.
There have been many evolutions, changes at Indianapolis and in open wheel racing in general since you've started. Certainly speed and safety foremost among those changes. What do you feel has been the most revolutionary change in all those years since you've been coming to Indy?
Well, there'd be many. Obviously, it's been, I think, the ground effects, you know, as far as really benefiting, you know, from the aerodynamics, you know, with the car on the top and underneath the car. But I think probably one of the most beneficial is the safety aspect, you know, that has been vigorously addressed for all the right reasons, you know, to give these guys the best possible chance to race again another day, you know, after a huge crash. And the sport has acted very responsibly in that respect, and not only the cars, but also, you know, on these ovals with the safe walls and all of those things that are very important to, you know, to be addressed. And that's really, to me, the most significant part, and what has given our sport, I think, more life, because the more commercial the sport is, the more of an impact, negative impact, would fatalities have. You know, unfortunately, you know, that's always going to be forever present. You know, it's you never have. You're not 100% safe anywhere. You know, but the fact that the sport is doing everything possible, I think is a big positive, and I'll hang on that one. I think the safety aspect is the most important thing that they've achieved, and to me, as time went on.
Looking forward to this year's race, we all know where your rooting interests lie, primarily with Marco and secondarily with the rest of Michael's team at Andretti Autosport. Marco's had 7 top 10s in his 10 attempts at Indy, including 3 straight finishes in the top 6. How do you assess his chances of getting the second Andretti Indy 500 win this year?
Quite honestly, I think he realistically has a very good chance winning. He certainly knows how to drive there, and he's shown that over and over. He loves the place. He looks forward to it, and in back of his mind, believe me, he'd like to sort of make up for some of our lost time, you know, from his dad and even mine, and be the one to, you know, to continue and just put some more numbers up there when it comes to that, you know, more faces on that BorgWarner trophy is what I'm saying, you know, so... again, you know, I know that he's geared up for that mentally, physically, and everything. To answer your question, I think he has a very, very realistic chance of winning that race, you know, sooner or later. And I hope it would be wonderful to see it this year, of course.
Mario, this was a real pleasure. Enjoy Indy once again, and thanks so much for your time today.
My pleasure, Brian.